Donald Trump's turbulent 4 years as U.S. president draw to a close.
We did what we came here to do.
The 46th president of the United States, Joseph R. Biden Jr.
This is America's day.
The new commander-in-chief heading straight to work.
Hello, I'm Richard Gisbert, and you're at The Listening Post, where we don't cover the news, we cover the way the news is covered. Here are the media stories we're looking at this week. Donald Trump leaves Washington to the sounds of Sinatra. We examine his legacy, his impact on American journalism, our way. Russia's Alexei Navalny, dissident, inmate, documentarian. Generational change in Nigeria and the story of police violence the mainstream media shied away from. And they say, to have another language
que l'élection présidentielle
is to have another soul.
This could very well.
Sin irregularidades, Donald Trump gehört haben, dass jetzt eine geordnete Amtsübergabe.
Introducing the most soulful TV correspondent ever. With Donald Trump finally out of the White House, shorn of his presidency and his Twitter account, the talk in Washington is of a return to normalcy. For American journalism and the country's toxic online media sphere, that will be easier said than done. Consider the after effects of these 4 years and the president's persistent attacks on reporters, all that talk of fake news. 3 out of 4 Republican voters are now saying they do not believe this was a fair election. Polls are indicating that trust in the American media continues to sink, whether journalists are covering politics or a pandemic, and conspiracy theorists who are more likely to believe QAnon than the New York Times running amok in the Capitol building. Once lost, trust is a difficult thing to rebuild. That is the challenge that U.S. media outlets are now facing. We're departing from our usual format this week. We've asked 4 Americans of different political stripes who know the media inside out to discuss the future of political journalism as the Biden era gets underway. Our starting point this week, Inauguration Day in Washington, D.C.
He circled the Capitol, surrounded by fence and razor wire and troops. That is his legacy. That is what he has left.
Have a good life. We will see you soon.
And surreally, the soundtrack that we continue to hear. Let's just watch in silence as this Air Force One takes off.
Was what he didn't say. No mention of the 400,000 lives lost, in sharp contrast with the empathy from Joe Biden.
Joe Biden comes in with a sense, I would describe it as a wellspring of goodwill.
There's a tremendous danger the press will just go back to the worst ways of covering presidents, which is being utterly deferential and stenographic.
People feel like they can wrap their arms around the idea of a Joe Biden presidency.
This is a moment of great consequence. So the press has to be on high alert every moment right now. And that means pushing Biden enormously and not just sitting back and hoping that he can take care of things.
We need a catharsis, and I think that Joe Biden is sort of human catharsis.
Congratulations. Treat every politician the way that you've been treating Donald Trump these last 4 years. When somebody is making a speech and something that they're saying is incorrect or misleading, you run a graphic just like you did with Donald Trump, saying this thing is not true.
This president is a serial liar, and he serially lied tonight. I counted.
Everything that you were doing for Donald Trump should be applied to every public figure in this country, because he's not unique. He was more dishonest than other politicians, but it was a difference in degree. And so if you really want to see major changes to our political culture, that would be one place to start.
This is a deeply disturbed man.
The clinical definition of a psychopath.
He is dangerously mentally ill.
They're working hard.
They have to focus more on policy than on personality. Really focus on, you know, where the rubber meets the road. What are the policies that are being made? And who is at the table where that policy is being made? Because it would return journalists to their primary mission, which really isn't to balance the left and right, and it isn't to train your camera on whoever is saying the wildest things. It really is to represent the way power works in this country so that people can see where they fit and what needs to happen for things to change.
At this hour, my friends, democracy has prevailed.
How aggressive are CNN and MSNBC going to be towards a Biden administration? I think you'll see CNN be pretty friendly.
Here's a man who gave Americans permission to feel good about who we are and what we can become again.
They will view the Biden administration as non-threatening, return to the status quo. I think you'll see their ratings slip because they won't have this constant clash between their personalities like Jim Acosta.
Why does Rudy Giuliani keep saying?
And whoever's giving the White House a press briefing.
However, we are a new country tonight.
An outlet like MSNBC will be interesting because there's someone like Rachel Maddow.
The administration is clearly making the pandemic priority number one.
Will they start hitting the Biden administration from the left, kind of as they began to do under Obama in terms of civil liberties concerns, drone strikes, things like that, or will they be more forgiving and friendly?
So let the hilarious fawning begin.
It is a love story between the press and Biden and you.
Fox is in a pickle, precisely because I don't know where they go. It seems like they can either go full Make America Great Again and unreality based, or they can, you know, adopt some sort of new reality based conservatism that that would involve a lot of boring re-education of their viewers. So I don't know what they do.
Well, they are throbbing like never before after 4 years without Obamagasms.
I think they'll stay where they've been, you know, for decades, casting the left as, you know, an existential threat to America, constantly harping on illegal immigration, the expansion of government.
Tonight is Joe Biden's first day in office, and you know what that means. CNN can finally take that COVID death ticker off the screen. There's no reason for it now.
But I'm looking at some of the voices like Tucker Carlson, who I think is charting new territory on the right and is going to be going after the left in somewhat unfamiliar terms.
He's not posing a threat to tech monopolies, of course not, after 50 years of shilling for corporations.
You know, attacking their coziness with Silicon Valley and with Wall Street. The influence of corporate power within the center left and the Democratic establishment. That's something new for the right.
The main figure to watch in conservative media is Tucker Carlson for the kinds of, I think, suburban audiences that might have been turned off by Trump's character and personality. He's the kind of trussed up, bow-tied version of that politics. He's somebody who thinks every day probably about running in 2024, and he very well might do it.
Coming up,
the media landscape will shift as the new administration comes into office. What you'll see is a little bit more unity on the right. You know, under Trump, there's been a split between, you know, Trump skeptical conservatives, never Trumpers, and then the kind of Trump boosting base. I think you'll see those various factions coalesce somewhat under a Biden administration. There's nothing like a common enemy to unite people.
Conservative movement has been spooked by losing the election.
He's not president of the United States anymore, and I can't stand that.
And there's some elements within the conservative coalition that are going to be interested in moving on from Trump.
If Democrats need thousands of troops to occupy the Capitol on Inauguration Day, then it seems possible that their candidate wasn't actually elected.
OAN and Newsmax represented closer connection to the base, and they're going to make different editorial decisions. And if these divisions persist, they're going to persist underneath a thick stack of conspiracy theories and propaganda.
Having people with that sort of worldview as part of the mainstream political discourse is deeply, deeply disturbing. I think they need to be marginalized and studied. I don't want to spend the next 4 years sitting around talking to QAnon people and just quoting whatever nonsense they say. I do want to spend a good chunk of the next 4 years talking to them and finding out how they got so disconnected from reality.
Obviously, this is a huge victory for these protesters. They have disrupted the system in an enormous way.
And media have to take seriously that these people will try again, that this is not over, and that returning to normal will not make it be over. We have to shine the clear spotlight on these ideas and not see them only as outliers, but trace the connections between the ideas of these extremists and the mainstream of the Republican Party.
Please raise your right hand and repeat after me.
We've gone through 4 years where nothing really was going on at the White House except for what Trump was tweeting. I would very much like to see all the networks actually do some more serious news coverage. And I think a plausible future for them involves actually reporting on the news and having people on their shows who are not simply opining about stuff, having major public figures being grilled every night on television. That would be actually a valuable contribution to our society.
To get it right in a Biden presidency, media would have to figure out what they got wrong under Trump.
Thank you, America.
And I'm not sure that I really see that happening. Corporate media really tell the same story, no matter who's in office. And that story is the system works.
Biden's faith is not just his Catholic faith, but he has great faith in the institutions of our democracy. He believes in them.
The United States is the best country in the world. And even though the presidency is different, I see corporate media bringing the same templates, the same frameworks to the discussion.
To the extent that people worried about political division, I don't think that's going to go away. And I don't know that journalism itself is going to be capable of making it go away. This is a deeply divided country and it always has been. I don't know that journalism can really change that. I do hope, though, that journalism will still provide people a way to understand what's happening around them.
Moving on to Russia now, where opposition figure Alexei Navalny is back in prison, but is still managing to make news. 2 days after he was jailed, a documentary appeared online, posted there by Navalny's team, a documentary very critical of President Vladimir Putin. Johanna Hus has been looking into this story for us. Joe, what did the film focus on?
Well, the documentary claims to offer an in-depth analysis of Putin's wealth, focusing on what it calls Putin's palace on the Black Sea. Now, this is a huge estate that Navalny claims is actually owned by Putin, but was paid for with illicit money by members of his inner circle.
Мы пойдем в гости к Путину. Своими глазами убедимся в том, что этот человек в своей тяге к роскоши, к богатству, спятил совершенно. Узнаем...
Navalny says that the idea for this corruption investigation actually came to him whilst he was being treated in Germany after he was poisoned in August last year, an attack that both he and human rights organizations say is actually orchestrated directly by Putin.
Now, what about the evidence offered in this doc? How credible is it, really?
Well, that's quite hard to know and verify, but the sourcing definitely is interesting because according to Navalny's anti-fraud foundation, the team actually based its reporting on quite detailed floor plans provided to them by a subcontractor who was actually involved in building the palace. They then used those documents, created 3D animations of the interiors, which include a theater, two spas, and even a casino.
Здесь неприступные заборы, свой порт, собственная охрана, церковь, свой пропускной пункт, бесполетная зона и даже собственный погранпункт.
Now, as to the evidence of the illicit funds used in the construction of this palace, well, Navalny presents financial records, evidence, he says, of the biggest bribe in history involving Putin and his allies. This story isn't at all new, though. Records of a secret palace first emerged more than a decade ago.
And what is the Kremlin saying about these allegations?
Flat-out denial. Officials have even said that Putin doesn't own any palaces and that this documentary is nothing but nonsense and old news. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the Kremlin-aligned media stuck to that official story. But the video has found an audience online. It has more than 43 million views.
Okay, thanks, Joe. The pandemic topped the global news agenda last year, followed by another story that traveled across borders, collective social unrest over police brutality. Africa's most populous country, Nigeria, was just one of the datelines involved. In the last few months of 2020, thousands of youths took to the streets, and social media was awash with the hashtag #EndSARS. SARS stood for the Special Anti-Robbery Squad, a police unit notorious for extortion, torture, and the extrajudicial killings of Nigerian citizens. The lack of mainstream media coverage of the protest movement proved to be a story in itself. The Listening Post's Nick Muirhead now on the EndSARS protests and the collective of new Nigerian media outlets that turned out to be the place to go for news coverage of the movement.
What you are looking at is the biggest collective protest movement in Nigeria's history. Day after day, tens of thousands of Nigerians turned out to demonstrate against police brutality.
I don't want to die young. I'm not a thief.
They were young and they were angry. Unemployment soared during the pandemic and many schools and universities were closed. With time on their hands, Nigerian youth were gathering online under the hashtag #EndSARS. SARS, or the Special Anti-Robbery Squad, was a notorious police unit that, for decades, brutalized the population. 2020 will go down as the year that the people fought back.
What we saw in October with the EndSARS is then the full emergence of the capacity of technology, particularly digital assets, to be able to help the reporting of cases of police brutality and violence, but also to provide evidence.
There were two videos that sparked outrage against police brutality and particularly against SARS. One video starts after the incident began, but what we do see is SARS officers drag out two men from a hotel compound. They're both limp, they're not moving. One of them is dragged out onto the street. The officer steps back, pulls his rifle and shoots him.
Brazen police brutality, no matter where it occurs, tends to take place when those wearing the uniform consider themselves above the law. And when you look more closely at the history of the SARS unit, you start to realize that from the very beginning, operating above the law was by design. In the early 1990s, Nigeria was immersed in a wave of violent crime. Police were overwhelmed and corrupt officers in the force were part of the problem. The SARS unit was established in 1992 and given license to operate undercover and outside of standard police regulations. The rationale for that was that corruption ran so deep in Nigerian institutions that it would take a unit operating outside of the police system to really tackle it. That's not what happened. Instead, the lack of oversight allowed the SARS unit to abuse its autonomy, and soon the accusations of police brutality started to stack up. Stephen Abayim, Chika Ibeku, Chidi Udinawa, just three examples of hundreds who lost their lives at the hands of SARS. For almost 30 years, the unit functioned with a lack of oversight on the part of the authorities and a lack of scrutiny, news coverage, by Nigerian media outlets.
Any journalist knows that police brutality is a horrific and universal issue. However, journalists in Nigeria don't operate in a space where they feel free enough to expose wrongdoing by powerful institutions. You are likely picking an issue with an institution or a figure that can come down quite hard on you.
There are no legislations in this country that effectively guarantees freedom for the press so that they can cover events of this nature without any hindrance or any harassment. In 2020 alone, we have recorded 155 abuses against journalists. Media freedom in this country really is at its most abysmal.
Mainstream media, they cover these stories, but what they don't do is follow up on these stories. So it just comes across as breaking news.
The policeman reportedly shot the deceased.
Almost a week after his disappearance, his body was discovered at a morgue in Ikorodu.
Kolade was reportedly murdered by operatives of Lagos State Police Command.
And then a few weeks later or months later, you don't get to hear anything about this again. So they haven't done justice as to reporting, championing our cries.
Given the Nigerian media's shortcomings on this story, the NSAR's protests offered journalists a shot at redemption. But they didn't really take it. In large part, the protests were ignored, at least initially. But then, on October 20th, 12 days into the protests, the Nigerian military opened fire on reportedly peaceful demonstrations. The government said two people were killed. Human rights groups put the number at 12. That's when the country's media regulator, the National Broadcasting Commission, told journalists to report the story, but in a way that would not embarrass the government. And many complied. They went from ignoring the story to taking aim at the protesters.
Old newspapers calling protesters hoodlums, thugs, referring to them and saying, "What do you want?" That's not surprising. And then on the opposite side of that, you have them kind of infantilizing them and saying, my children, what do these children want? These are grown people, some of them with their own families, and then you have older, usually gentlemen, in office referring to them as children. It's absurd.
One injustice the mainstream media did was trying to undermine why we were out there on the streets.
Gives a vivid picture of an outcome of terror unleashed by hoodlums.
Our parents didn't know why we were protesting, because most of them don't use social media, and the only ways they could have gotten this news was via newspapers and TV shows. But these people weren't talking about it for a long time.
Nigeria has a youthful population. 60% of citizens are under 25 years old. That's roughly 120 million young people. And when you look at the faces of those who lost their lives to police brutality, one thing stands out. Almost all of them were young. So it is not incidental that it was young online news outlets like Sikoko, Republic, and more branches that finally gave this issue the coverage it needed.
From the start, more branches said, you know what? We're coming for these topics. We're coming to highlight what's happening in these communities and be a voice for these people. We pretty much focused on going to these protest locations. So we had reporters in Alausa, in Lekki, and in Ikorodu taking videos, reporting live on social media, going live.
You got the sense that digital media were interested in the perspective of the protesters. They were not interested in infantilizing them, in bringing down or giving the sense that these are just young people making noise. They were interested in why these young people were out there and what the government response was like in their eyes. I think young people saw their press, maybe some for the first time, that they were trying to hold government accountable. Your purpose in the media is to report the truth, to have a voice for those who do not have a voice, which is many, many groups of people in Nigeria.
Last year, the Nigerian youth found a voice online. It started as a hashtag, but grew into a movement that, backed by a collection of new media outlets, held power to account. And on October 11th, 2020, SARS was disbanded. Officials were quick to replace it with a new police unit called SWAT, but they will know that this time, a new media collaboration of young citizens and journalists alike will be watching.
And finally, these days, CVs come in all shapes, sizes, and formats. Take the Associated Press journalist Philip Crowther. His Twitter bio says he reports in 6 different languages. Crowther backed that up by posting a video of himself doing live reports on American politics in each of those languages. It was impressive. Crowther's video went viral, which would have been by design. We journalists aren't really known for our modesty. Sometimes our posts aren't really about the story. They're about us, our egos. Online job applications, otherwise known as demande d'emploi, application de trabajo, demanda de lavoro. Just putting it out there. We'll see you next time. here at the Listening Post.
Beaucoup des partisans de Donald Trump, en fait, lui croient quand il dit que l'élection présidentielle lui a été volée.
This could very well, here in Dalton, in northern Georgia, be the very last rally for Donald Trump as president of the United States.
Los funcionarios me dicen que el proceso se ha llevado a cabo sin irregularidades. Ambos los candidatos demócratas en las elecciones de segunda vuelta para el Senado de Georgia ya declararon sus respectivas victorias.
Und in Washington direkt vor dem Weißen Haus ist unser Reporter Philip Crowther.
Es ist so, dass wir effektiv von Donald Trump gehört haben, dass er jetzt eine geordnete Amtsübergabe sehen will. Und Nationalgarde, also endlich gestern nur lange Stunden. Und dann spürt man beim Präsidenten doch auch den Druck von Mitgliedern seiner eigenen republikanischen Partei und auch von Mitgliedern seines eigenen inneren Kreises im Weißen Haus.
Sagt Philip Crowther, RTL Washington. Vielen Dank für Ihre Einschätzung heute früh.